On January 20th, 2017, thousands gathered in the nation's capital to protest Donald Trump's rise to power and the increase in bigotry and hate-fueled rhetoric around the so-called United States that accompanied it. Of the many protests that happened that week, an anti-fascist, anti-capitalist march was preemptively targeted, indiscriminately attacked, and eventually kettled. After being detained on the street in winter weather for hours without access to food, water, bathrooms, or medical treatment, over 230 people were arrested by the D.C. Metropolitan Police Department. This group includes journalists, legal observers, medics, and bystanders. 214 of those arrested were charged months later after an additional superseding indictment with 8 felonies each and a smattering of other charges, revealing a chilling new strategy of state repression. Since then, there has been over a year and a half of organizing and resistance and an outpouring of national and global support. The first trial, consisting of 6 of the J20 protesters, resulted in full acquittals, and shortly after, 129 of the cases were dismissed. But 58 people still have at minimum 6 felony and 2 misdemeanor charges, which can carry a penalty of up to 60 years in federal prison. The next round of trials began May 14th, with new trials starting concurrently throughout the summer. Here are the latest updates. And for a more detailed history of the case up to this point and a play-by-play of the first trial, find our first podcast series at itsgoingdown.org.
In this podcast, we're going to talk about where we are in the cases, sort of logistical updates, what cases are happening, where they are. We're going to do a little bit of analysis of the case, and then we're going to talk about some moments from court over the past few weeks.
If people listen to the first podcast series, there are many parts of this trial that have been described as deja vu in court, calling the same witnesses, laying like nearly an identical framework. And you can kind of expect this to be happening all summer long with all of these trials. Right now, we are in the third week of one trial, and we are starting the first week of another trial at the same time. And then 1 week from now will be the start of a third trial. Trials are going to be happening like this all summer long. Please come out and support in person if you can.
Yeah, there's tons to do on the ground. We definitely need volunteers to pick up food, be emotional support, all sorts of things. And it's really fun, right?
Yeah.
We're having fun. You could have fun with us. It's great. In this section, we're going to be reframing the government's case. We're going to talk about the themes that the prosecution revisits, but we're going to flip them on their head and describe them from an anarchist perspective and through our own lens. First, the prosecution wants to unmask what they call criminals. But let's talk about who these people are and why someone might be called a criminal by the prosecution.
We want to unmask why people were there and the many reasons why people are now finding themselves at trial for participating in an anti-capitalist, anti-fascist march. That is to say that people were all there for their own reasons, to express anger over the oppression we all face for living in a white supremacist state. The defendants are women, queer, trans, people of color, Black and brown and indigenous people, poor, working class people who are fed up with the bullshit.
The prosecution wants to talk about violence. And when they say violence, they mean property destruction. But from an anarchist perspective, what kind of violence are we seeing at trial?
We're watching police brutality. We're watching police beating people with batons, spraying OC pepper spray directly into people's faces. And the fact that these police are here means that it's their job to do this every day to Black and brown and poor people. If you want to talk about violence, let's talk about the violence of capitalism. Capitalism is inherently violent. There is violence when Bank of America invests in extractive industry and forces displacement through foreclosure and supports things like the DAPL, Bayou Bridge, and Atlantic Coast pipelines, and terrorizes people who oppose unsustainable gas and oil dependency. There is violence when Starbucks calls the cops on Black people and uses industrial agriculture to produce coffee by killing rainforests and displacing indigenous communities. And then there's the systemic violence of a white supremacist state which is founded on and perpetuates the oppression of Black and brown and queer and women and gender nonconforming and trans people, and denies that racism and oppression exist.
Right. The prosecution also wants to talk about a sea of black. They keep coming back to the concept of a sea of black as a threatening, menacing presence storming down the streets of good, law-abiding citizens. They're trying to paint a sinister portrait. But from our perspective, what is this sea of black? What does it mean?
A sea of black is an expression of solidarity and protest of medics and comrades and affinity groups to protect each other and to watch each other's back and to say, hey, comrade, how are you? Do you feel safe right now?
I do feel safe. Do you feel safe?
I feel pretty safe in this moment.
Me too. Finally, the prosecution keeps talking about DC residents being scared. That's a line that they've really been going with a lot this trial, talking about the terror of people seeing this horrifying sea of black. But what is it that DC residents were probably mostly scared of on that day?
DC residents were scared of Trump and scared of the police violence happening that day, scared of the militarism displayed by the state against protesters through the flashbangs of sting ball grenades, spraying the streets with OC pepper spray, cops chasing protesters with batons and tasers and weapons.
Next, we're going to be discussing updates and moments from court.
So let's talk about Brady violations and Rule 16 violations. We looked it up so you don't have to. So, what is a Brady violation? This is when the prosecution suppresses evidence that is materially exculpatory, a phrase which here means it's relevant and could impact the case, and that it is favorable to defendants.
Brady violations are super evil. When you hear horror stories in the news or on TV shows about people going to prison or death row because of prosecutorial cover-ups, there are generally Brady violations involved. It's more insidious than that, though. Most Brady violations are never uncovered. Because prosecutors have access to police resources and records and the defense doesn't, it's super easy for information that would show a defendant to be not guilty never to reach the courtroom. Because prosecutors' careers are built on sending people to prison, there's a strong incentive for them to lie. And it's difficult to catch. This case isn't exceptional in that a Brady violation was committed. It's exceptional in that it was proven in court against unlikely odds. Usually, the defense doesn't have the resources.
And then a Rule 16 violation is about discovery and inspection of evidence. And I'll give you the direct quote from the legal language. So, upon a defendant's request, the government must permit the defendant to inspect and to copy or photograph books, papers, documents, data, photographs, tangible objects, buildings or places, or copies or portions of any of these items, if the item is within the government's possession, custody, or control, and the item is material to preparing the defense.
And what we're about to talk about is definitely material to preparing the defense, and definitely was within the government's possession and control.
So, in other words, Kirchhoff hid and lied about a piece of evidence which is favorable to defendants and could change the course of a trial proceeding. The Brady violation was proven in court this week by the June 4th trial defense during a motion to dismiss the charges. Mind you, this was happening during the middle of a different trial group, which had just watched the video in open court.
This story of just how deceptive Kirchhoff was is so wild that we're going to quote from the motion filed by defense attorneys at length because it's a heck of a ride.
In the defendant's motion to compel the Project Veritas video in question, the government stated the following on record. We provided to defense counsel the video. The only editing that was done by my office was at the very beginning of the video. And it recorded in segments. And I'm not sure why, if that's how the button camera was recording. That's common with cameras, that it records in segments. At the very beginning, it shows an individual who's wearing the camera in the bathroom. It shows their face. We cut that part out and then provided everything else to the defense counsel. We did crop out the undercover officer's face, which is after the communication of the planning meeting. The camera pans around you and you can see him, and the defense has the exact video we have.
So for those of you keeping count at home, this means that in one statement, Kirchhoff iterated three times by saying the only editing that was done, by saying, we cut that part out, and then provided everything else to the defense counsel, and then by saying the defense has the exact video that we have, directly stated unambiguously 3 times that there wasn't any other relevant information in this video. Well, guess what there was in this video? Relevant exculpatory information.
To refer to that exact quote in the video, the Project Veritas agent said at the very end, I was talking with one of the organizers from the IWW, and I don't think they know anything about any of the upper echelon stuff.
Yeah, when someone denies something 3 times, that means that they probably did it, if they're Kirchhoff, talking about how there's nothing in this video that could possibly be relevant.
And so in the motion, this is exculpatory evidence to the defense. What better exculpatory evidence for the defense than the words from the person sent to capture a nefarious meeting, stating right after the meeting, I don't think they know anything. This directly speaks to Kirchhoff's whole MO throughout this entire case, which is withholding evidence, supplying it at the last minute or in the middle of a trial proceeding. And in this case, only after defense counsel filed a motion to compel her to provide evidence. So she has been doing this. She's been doing everything in her power to hide evidence. And you know, if she's doing it in this case, she's doing it in other cases. This is clearly her tactic. What's also funny about this is that this is a Project Veritas video that we're talking about here. This is what Project Veritas is known for and why they are a discredited group, because they edit video so that it's misleading and only shows what they want, like this narrative that they want to put out there, which is a lie.
You definitely can't accuse the prosecution of not engaging in poetry with just how suitable their particular form of Brady violation was.
So this basically created chaos in the courthouse. It has implications for the current case. The video has already been shown without the exculpatory quote, and the motion was filed by only 2 trial groups, the current and the June 4th. And we have another case starting on May 29th.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what this means for other cases moving forward, and definitely for the current trial block. There were other notable moments in court this past week. We were presented with a masterclass in thin blue line reality denialism by Officer Chapman of the MPD. Much of the testimony consisted of looking at videos of obvious police brutality, while a calm man in a uniform firmly denied that that was what was happening. We saw this in the first trial as well. The jury was repeatedly shaken by graphic videos of violence, followed by calm assertions that what they had just seen was perfectly normal. Particularly chilling was a moment in which a gaggle of terrified and pepper-sprayed protesters hugged and comforted each other, with no orders from law enforcement audible. Chapman called this image the definition of resisting arrest, despite the fact that neither resistance nor arrest were visible. This postmodern perjury is just one form of abusive gaslighting constantly experienced by marginalized communities. The jury was visibly shaken by the brutality on screen, but a police officer in uniform reassuring everyone that everything is totally normal and justified can sway a lot of people, despite what their eyes tell them. Another notable moment of testimony in court was the testimony by Pemberton, the prosecution's star witness and the lead detective in the case. Pemberton is a member of the prosecution's team. We see him at court every single day, scurrying around, carrying boxes and uncomfortably large poster board for the prosecution. He has a desk in their office, and they're using his personal computer as their computer to present evidence. He is part of their team, and he's also their star witness, which seems ridiculously biased to anyone paying attention. He's also a representative for the police union, and there is a civil lawsuit against police officers who he represents. Their star witness is probably the most biased individual you could possibly imagine.
So what is the difference between this trial and the first one in terms of what the prosecution is reframing and what is the same? Well, the evolution of the prosecution's case at this point has been to focus more on the group, and there has been a lot of, like, going back and forth on language around, like, like, how to refer to the group in court. And at one point, like, early on in the case, Kirchhoff tried to bar defense from referring to protesters as protesters. She literally tried to deny that this is a protest, which is completely absurd, to try to depoliticize, like, the most political thing.
Fortunately, the judge ruled that she didn't really want to hear the word protest unless it came out of a witness's mouth first, and the first word that comes out of most witnesses' mouths is a sentence about the protesters. So it hasn't ended up working too poorly for the defense so far, because this is so obviously a protest. But what's egregious is how reality is just being denied by the court. What's next? Like we said, there's trial every week, all summer and all fall. It's somewhat likely some of these trials will be continued, but for now we have trials scheduled nonstop every business day for pretty much the foreseeable future. Coming down and helping would be greatly appreciated, and definitely let us know if you're coming up and we can plug you into ways to be useful. Join us next time for a discussion of what legally is going on in the case. You definitely know that they initially charged 200 people with breaking the same several windows, but how are they doing that? What is their theory of liability, and how does that work? Next time we'll discuss that, as well as share more moments in court with you, which there will be plenty of, because we're going to have two concurrent trials, and we'll give you more updates on the case.
Much of the government's conspiracy case is oriented around criminalizing common protesting tactics like chanting, wearing similar clothing, meeting at a predetermined location for a public march, and the presence of medics and legal observers. It is clear that prosecutors continue to pursue this case in an effort to chill dissent. There is, of course, the added bonus that they would be helping protect the MPD from lawsuits over police misconduct. Police violence and extreme charges against those who resist is nothing new, but the extent and absurdity of the prosecution's case marks a shift in the recent suppression of movements for liberation. Whatever happens in these trials will surely impact dissent across the United States, just as resistance becomes more and more necessary. So on that note, we want you to know that it's never too late to get involved. There is a constant need for support and visibility around this case. You can find trial updates, fundraising info, and other ways to take action at defendj20resistance.org, or you can follow defendj20 on Instagram and Twitter, or at defendj20resistance on Facebook. Stand with us as we stand against Trump and the world he seeks to maintain.